On today's show, I have a great guest. I'm so excited that she's here with us in the studio. It's Catherine Truitt, Chancellor of WGU North Carolina, Western Governors University, North Carolina. She has been in our area for 11 years. WGU, let me give them a little bit about that first. They are an 100% online university, a nonprofit university dedicated to changing lives through higher education. And prior to joining WGU, Catherine served as the Associate Vice President of the University and P-12 partnerships at UNC General Administration. Catherine and her team worked to strengthen our educator pipeline and support our public colleges of education through a student's first lens, committed to improving educational outcomes for all of North Carolina's children. From 2015 to 2016, Catherine served as the senior editor, education advisor to the governor, Pat McCrory. In this role, she coordinated policy for all facets of public education, from pre-K through the UNC system. Catherine worked to ensure all North Carolina students received the high-quality education they need to be college and career-ready in a global economy. Between 1998 and 2012, Catherine practiced her passion for high-impact teaching in varied educational settings over 12 years spanning grades 4 through 12. After teaching literature at a public high school in Seattle area, Catherine moved to Chicago, where she co-founded a K-8 parent-run private school on Chicago's South Side, followed by 4 years of teaching in the British school system. After returning to the United States, Catherine had settled in Raleigh, North Carolina, where she taught American literature to 11th graders at West Johnston High School in Johnston County. In 2012, Catherine joined the International Center for Leadership in Education, where she served nationally as a turnaround coach in underperforming public schools. Catherine lives in Cary with her husband Jeff, an attorney and captain in the U.S. Navy Reserves. They have 3 children in the Wake County Public Schools. She is committed to the core belief that all people have a fundamental human right to maximize their potential. And WGU North Carolina is a competency-based university established to expand access to higher education for North Carolina residents. The university offers more than 60 undergraduate and graduate degree programs in the field of business, K-12 teacher education, information technology, and health professions, including nursing. Degrees are granted under the accreditation of the Western Governors University, which is accredited through the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, or the NWCCU. They're driving innovation as the nation's leading competency-based university. WGU has been recognized by the White House, state leaders, employers, and students as a model that works in post-secondary education. WGU has been named one of the fast companies, most innovative companies, and has been featured on NPR, NBC Nightly News, CNN, and in the New York Times. And you can learn more about them at nc.wgu.edu. And Catherine, thank you so much for joining us on the program today. And I also want to tell everyone she just won the Republican nomination to compete for the Supervisor of Public Instruction.
Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Yeah. That's such a different label for...
It's basically the Secretary of Education,
right,
for a state. Yeah, we just call it something a little different.
We give here a few more words in there.
Yeah.
So, Catherine, tell us about why you're running for that position, how that fits into the scope of everything that you've been passionate about in education, and just kind of fill us in on what's going on in WGUNC and the track of education in North Carolina.
Yeah. My entire teaching career has been about serving kids who are marginalized and low income for the most part, including my time teaching in England, where I had the privilege of teaching just outside of London, where most of my students were actually immigrants from other countries. And it was a very eye-opening experience about what happens when immigrants come to another country when they're escaping something else in search of a better life. My time as a turnaround coach was spent in high-poverty school districts where zip code truly determines one's education outcome and pathway in life. So a lot of the experiences I've had in my teaching career have shown me what education can do, but also it's highlighted for me what it has not done but should do.
Yeah, I mean, somebody has more letters after her name than in her name. Education has always been something that, I mean, I'm a lifelong learner. I can't go a day without looking at something new and trying to learn something. So not when I encounter people who don't have the educational background to do what they want. They're an inventor, a business owner that can't read the financial statements, but they're fantastic at what they do. And how the door opens when you start giving them more information and equipping them to do more things and have more choices. I mean, I'm amazed when I run into solo entrepreneurs that can't read, can't do math, all those kinds of things. But they have this phenomenal memory.
And passion.
And passion. But that memory isn't saying that they weren't capable of learning. It's saying that somewhere in the educational system, something didn't connect with them.
That's right. Right? That's exactly right. Yeah. Right now in North Carolina, 65% of eighth graders do not read on grade level.
Wow.
And the same amount are not proficient in math. And this is actually, we're not too far off the mark from other states. I mean, this is a trend. And I have my own theories about why this is that has very much to do with the way we teach reading.
Yes.
To young children. And it's pretty, pretty disturbing. Only 41% of people in North Carolina have training and education beyond high school.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, I think back, I grew up in West Virginia, and everyone thinks, well, you know, bad schools, you know, poor.
Right.
And we may not have had the most resources, but in a lot of ways, we had the most discipline that when we were in there, we wanted to take advantage of everything that was there. And I know as I got older and moved through the system, you could see the school system change on how they were teaching.
Right.
You know, you weren't teaching to the highest standard. It kind of got backed off. And I can remember one of my best friends, her brother was labeled as basically unteachable, incorrigible, slow, or whatever. Mm. Turned out he had a genius IQ. He was
right.
just completely bored, and they weren't giving him the information fast enough or in the way he wanted it. So what did he do? He acted out.
Yep.
He entertained himself. I mean, he'd look at something, and he'd have all the math problems done in like 30 seconds in his head. He didn't show the work. But, you know, it's those kind of things. And so when we're not looking at every student and saying, okay, what is that potential? Do they learn visually? Do they learn by doing things? Do they learn by listening? And getting them the information and figuring out, how do we maximize that student? Yes, there's 20, 30, 40 students in there. And there might be, I think one of the Durham schools, someone was telling me, had 47 different languages in there. And so how do we manage all that? We have tools, we have resources, we have technology.
Right.
But we don't seem to be harnessing that.
Right. Well, and I also think that's where school choice comes in. This is an issue that divides Republicans and Democrats. Interestingly enough, the school choice or the charter school movement started with President Obama. He was a big believer in the power of charter schools to lift people out of poverty. And our Race to the Top grant that we received in 2010 actually mandated that we do charter school expansion in North Carolina. And so I think that when I think about school choice and some of the issues that you just mentioned, Lee, I think about how if a school is not meeting the needs of my child, I'm going to look elsewhere.
Right.
And I would have the option of paying for a private school that may better suit the needs of my child. But if I'm economically disadvantaged, I don't have those options. And so charter schools that are neighborhood schools are often able to give families a way out of perhaps a school that has been failing for generations.
You know, I was at a nail salon one day, and we got onto the subject of busing students and moving schools not in their neighborhood and things. And so I said, well, you know, they need to get in a better neighborhood, and they need their parents involved. I said, yeah, but if I'm busing a student an hour away from home, and chances are if they're low income, their parents can't spend an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours on the bus to get across town because they don't have the car. They don't have to get money for the gas.
Yes.
Or they can't take the time off from their minimum wage job to do things at the school. So the more we have neighborhood schools, the more we have options and homeschooling. I mean, I see more and more of my friends homeschooling their kids, even their grandchildren.
Wow.
And so why? Well, they didn't want to bus somewhere. They wanted more control of the curriculum. The kids learn differently.
Yeah.
You know, there's just all of these different things. And so they look at the online schools, the free ones, the private ones, the all these different options we have. But so many people don't have those options. They don't have internet and computers in their home.
Right.
They can't stay home with their kids to homeschool. There aren't enough charter schools. There's all of these different things. And so the lower your income and the more disadvantaged, the less options you're given if you start eliminating access to charter schools and things like that.
I can customize a salad at Panera, but I cannot customize my child's education.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There are unintended consequences of everything that we try in education, right? And the more choice we have, the more likely those unintended consequences will not have as large an impact.
Well, and we look at the immigrants coming into our community that give us the diversity, but their approach and their perspective on if they're from India or China or how they came out of systems that...
Or an African refugee.
Right.
I mean, that's, definitely.
So if they're coming because they had advantages or their parents had education from there and they can immigrate, or they're coming as refugees that now not only are they coming to somewhere they don't speak the language, but they're dealing with PTSD, the trauma.
Right.
You know, they're uprooted. And so there's all of these different dynamics that these kids are having to deal with.
Right.
And the parents, if the parents come, well, we have so many that don't have their unaccompanied minors coming in from all these different countries.
Yes.
And so there's all of these dynamics that we don't address by saying, okay, we want everybody to be individual within this constraint.
Correct.
Right.
You can have any color you want as long as it's blue. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
And it's a challenge. And I know it puts more stress on the teachers and things too because of the diversity, the lack of resources.
Mm-hmm.
But the more we don't optimize those resources, the more that we're losing 65% is basically what you're saying.
Right.
Of our eighth graders, if they can't do math and they can't do reading.
Right.
The basics that are the gateway skills.
Right.
To everything else you're going to do. They don't have options.
Right. And let me add to that, 12% of African-American boys in North Carolina in the eighth grade read proficiently.
12%?
Yes. 3% read well above grade level. So we have some serious challenges facing us.
I mean, that just boggles the mind because we seem to think throwing more and more money at it is the solution.
Right.
But obviously that's not working because that number is going, the numbers are going the wrong way.
Right. I would remind your listeners that the achievement gap, it has been in existence for over 20 years. This is not a new issue. The issues we have in public schools right now today cross multiple administrations from both parties.
Right.
And so we, as much as we can, need to depoliticize education and start looking at what is best for kids.
Well, I mean, you know, when we're trying to standardize the education curriculum nationally, I argue against that because then you have even less choice. If state by state we can set up curriculum based on what West Virginia needs versus what North Carolina needs, what all these different areas. So, yeah, reading proficiencies, math proficiency and stuff. But let us try different approaches and different curriculum. And if 50 states are doing it, then there's going to be something different. But we customize it to a large degree in our post-secondary education.
That's right.
We can go online to school. We can start online colleges at 14, 15, 16, whatever you can get the admission in
mm-hmm.
the, in there. And, we have non-traditional campuses. I know one of my first jobs was running a college bookstore for a college campus that was a physical building and stuff, but they didn't have physical classrooms.
Right.
They were across two states with their classrooms.
Yeah.
And you could take any class you wanted, any time you wanted, so anything could start and go. And so there's this diversity that we put in the post-secondary education where everybody's paying for it one way or the other, borrowing
mm-hmm.
money
mm-hmm.
to the nth degree. To,
yes,
the whole
that's right. $44 billion in student debt in North Carolina right now with a billion with a B.
Yeah. I mean, and then you come out, and I see so many people don't even come out with what I call a functioning degree.
Or they're not finishing at all.
Right.
And actually, to your point, the UNC system wrote a piece called the Partway Home Initiative, where they looked at who and how many and for what reasons do their students stop out right. before they finish that four-year degree. And in the UNC system, 50% of those who stopped out had a GPA of between 2.7 and 3.3. So there were other barriers at work.
Well, and it's like you're working for, I mean, I went back for my second master's online, which I actually have to say, I like the online experience as an adult mm-hmm. who learns at a different, in a different way, mm-hmm. and at a different pace, much better than going to a classroom and trying to fit into something that's designed for an 18 to 22 year old, right?
Right.
And so that experience, though, is, and going back and seeing the diversity of the age, we had 21 year olds in it and we had 78 year olds in the same
yeah.
class sex.
Yeah.
And they were from all these different countries. So we mm-hmm. had somebody sitting in Australia, somebody in Korea, somebody was... So that diversity of discussion and things, but the obstacles that came into that was English as a second language.
Mm-hmm.
We're translating... My second master's is in biblical studies.
Mm.
And so we're translating Greek
and Hebrew.
And Hebrew and Arabic into English
right.
or into... From the English, they translate... And so you start seeing even an adult level where learning styles came in,
mm-hmm.
where how much time you're going to devote to it. Did your work schedule cut into it? Because, mm-hmm. you know, it was supposed to be 15 to 20 hours a week of work, and it was more like 40 hours. And if you're working an 80-hour work week, and you have a spouse, and you have kids, and all these demands, you started to see people drop out.
Right.
And it wasn't the content of the class. It was the how much time it took or the other demands on their time. And I know at one point I got called for jury duty. My mother had a fall. I had my own business. You know, it's just like, and so all of those demands, I could work ahead. I could work around. I could stay up. But I
right.
didn't have kids and a spouse on top of
right.
that, right? Where other people were just, and that's what I see with kids. Their parents don't have the money. They're borrowing money. They might be working. Or they just might get discouraged and bored from having to hit those metrics mm-hmm. or those do it so, this way, do it that way.
So one of the things that is really our secret sauce at WGU is that every student has a mentor. And they have a mentor from the very first day that they start their classes with us. And that mentor helps them through all the kinds of things that you just mentioned.
Is that a peer mentor? Is it?
It's a mentor who has worked in the field that the student is studying. So if you are getting your bachelor's of nursing, your mentor is a nurse. If you are studying to be a teacher, your mentor is a teacher. They really come alongside you and are with you every step of the way. And sometimes, you know, they're just a cheerleader,
right.
which is very important. But other times they are, you know, if there's a natural disaster and you lose, when we had the flooding in Texas
right.
and the flooding on the east part of North Carolina, your mentor can help you pause what's happening and help you get a new laptop or whatever you need.
It's that phone a friend, that lifeline.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And also... 43% of our students are first-generation college goers.
Wow.
So they have special needs as well because they might not know how to navigate even the enrollment system of higher education, which can be tricky if you're trying to transfer credits, apply for scholarships, complete the financial aid form, all of those things. And so we have... When someone calls WGU, they are assigned a dedicated enrollment counselor, and that enrollment counselor stays with them throughout the entire process.
Well, and that's really important. It's like in my family, my dad went to college. He was a professional civil engineer. My uncle's a mechanical. So one side of the family is that. The other side of the family, I don't know of anybody in the immediate family that had gone to college.
Mm-hmm.
So that contrast... my grandfather didn't go to school past the third grade, but he was a highly intelligent man. He was driven to read. He got the reading and the math
mm-hmm.
back from, you know,
mm-hmm.
the early 20th century that
mm-hmm.
you didn't progress grade to grade until you got the reading and the math. So because he had those skills, the world was still his oyster.
Right.
He could read a book on Harry Truman.
Right.
He could do whatever he wanted. He was fantastic at math when it was sports statistics.
Right,
you know,
right.
Or
yes.
things that were practical.
Yeah.
But when we don't equip the kids from right. kindergarten, and the other thing is, just this week I ran into a lady at a coffee shop. She had her little girl with her, and she was two. But when she hits, she wasn't even in pre-K, right? She hadn't done anything. But she could spell her name. She mm-hmm. was doing colors. She knew what opposites were. And I was just, and I was kind of fascinated because the whole time they were eating their breakfast, it was an educational experience. The mom was right. engaged with them. It's like, well, what does that mean? And right. can you spell that? And I thought she was older than two. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. and, but when she gets into school, the concern would have to be, well, she's self-driven. She's learning. She's
right.
But what stimulus is she going to get? What's she going to get?
Right.
If she comes in and has to go through the system in the prescribed manner,
right.
She's going to get bored long before they start yeah. engaging her at the level she's going
to. And
come in
at. That same classroom, you are likely to have someone who is from a high poverty family,
right.
and that pre-K or that kindergartner is only going to have heard a fraction of the words
right.
that other child has heard. I mean, there are studies that I can't remember the exact yeah. number of what the difference is of the number, the vocabulary
right.
That kid will have
environmentally,
heard.
Environmentally, because, again, we started reading early and doing things early. I had an older brother, so when he was learning multiplication tables, I wasn't even school yet, but I was hearing the multiplication tables and absorbing them. So it was those kind
right.
of things. And so having those advantages of how does your family learn?
Mm-hmm.
Is your family a lifelong learner? Or, mm-hmm. or are you just struggling?
Are you just struggling to make ends meet? Exactly.
And you're just engaged in trying to survive and
right.
provide those things.
Right.
So I remember when my niece, the way her birthday fell,
mm-hmm.
she had to test to be, she would be younger than admission. My brother and his wife wanted her in there. And so they tested her. And so her vocabulary, nobody talked down to her. If we said something, she picked it up. And for me, I was explaining things like I'd go there and I'd be working at the dining room. She'd say, what are you doing, Aunt Lee? I'm doing a budget. What's a budget? And I would literally tell her and explain
right.
what a budget was. So when they were testing her and she was using all these words, you don't know what they are, and she would reel out the definition, right?
Mm.
And my brother was pretty much cracking up. He goes, you can blame my sister. And then as we progressed, everything was, we did word games. And I'm kind of, if the listeners will tell you this, it's like I kind of have an odd approach to things. But one day she said some word ending in L-Y. And I said, oh, thank you. You called me pretty or whatever it was. And she's like, what? And I said, you said prettily, right? Or something like that. And so it became a game.
Yeah.
So we kept generating all these L-Y words. And so one day, both of them were in their middle school and elementary school, and the assignment was L-Y words. And somebody, the teacher says, do you want to start? And who can name them? And they just started reeling them off, you know,
mm-hmm.
different parts of the school. And the teacher looked at them and said, why do you know that many L-Y? She goes, my aunt's name is Lee. And they're like, what does that have to do with anything? But everything
right.
is a learning advantage, right?
Sure.
So if you,
yes.
what's the spreadsheet?
Yes.
What are you doing this?
Yes.
Get on the computer. I had gotten some kind of animation software for doing cartoons and stuff. And so I just let her play with it. And
right.
She learned it before I did. She
yeah.
was like five.
Yeah.
And so it's what opportunities are they getting?
Right.
But we kind of kill the learning, the passion.
Right.
When we get in the school systems.
Yeah. And back to your earlier point about people you've encountered who have a passion, but they don't have
the book learning.
The book learning. We, the beauty of a competency-based education is that you are, rather than collecting credit hours, you're collecting competencies. You are checking off competencies as you work through your education. And so if you come to WGU North Carolina with a, let's say you've been working as an accountant without a degree for years and years and years.
And there are thousands of them.
That's right. If that's you and you're like, you know what? I am really worried if, you know, God forbid the next recession comes or I can make more money,
right.
you know, I'm getting paid less money because I don't have a degree. That's who a lot of our students are. And because they don't have the degree, but they have all of those, that work experience, they're going to move more quickly through our program because it's self-paced and that you can move as quickly as you would like.
So what about those common requirements for a bachelor's degree in biology and chemistry and stuff? I mean, it's been so long. Are they all still there?
So in order, so you mentioned our accreditation at the beginning of the show. Regional accreditation in the United States is the gold standard for accreditation. So each region of the U.S. has its own. Ours in the Southeast is called SACS. And so our, because we are headquartered in Utah, we fall under the Northwest Commission, okay, instead of the Southeast Commission. But it's the same thing. So we have the same accreditation as any UNC system school or Wake Forest or Duke, what have you. And so we are, those gen ed classes are part of maintaining
the accreditation.
The accreditation.
So I know when I, and again, I'm one of those people that looks at the system and says, okay, how do I make it work for me? So when I went for my undergrad bachelor's degree, I looked at the course program and realized if I started with the associate program, I didn't have to take introduction to economics and introduction to management and introduction stuff. So I signed up for the associate degree first, and they worked on me for, I let them work on me for a couple years to get me to switch to the bachelor's program. And then I waited till just like halfway through that fourth semester and said, yeah, you're right, I'll go for the bachelor's degree. And then they sat down and they realized, because I had done it the way I did, they had to waive 36 hours of introductory classes. So that opened up potential for additional majors and minors. And so I almost ran out of business classes to take because I had so many extra hours.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, and I tried to tell kids, it's like, okay, if you're having to pay for it yourself, work. Don't go into debt, or go, if you're going to go into, and you want to go to Harvard, well, go to Harvard for something the Harvard, having a Harvard degree is going to make a difference in.
Right.
Focus on your grades. Focus on what is it you want that degree to do for you and make it work. Because if, like you're saying, life experience, job experience is going to translate into credits.
Right.
And so if you can do that and you can work, get the experience, stay out of debt, it gives you more options in which career path you're going to take, and you can move around. You have all of this. And really focus on learning what it is you are passionate, what you want to do.
Absolutely.
And how you're going to apply it. And then yeah, if you have to take those other courses. Okay, right. I did. Right. That was my, I mean, it was like my last semester of college was taking biology and all that stuff. But by that time, I could write papers. Like I wrote a biology paper on the biological, political, and economic ramifications of oil spills that the professor ended up giving at a conference, because I had spent that time doing business cases and things. And so even when I got to the general ed classes, they had a different meaning for me if I was going to be running businesses and things. Biology applied into businesses. You know, there wasn't a general thing that didn't have a perspective based on what I wanted to do with my career in business that didn't now have more meaning to me other than I'm looking at a dissection of an earthworm.
Right.
You know, stuff had more meaning.
Well, that's why we're
with more maturity.
We have always been workforce aligned. I mean, we were created by a bipartisan group of governors from states that had workforce needs. And they leveraged the dawn of the internet and started an online university. And so it, by only having those four colleges, IT, business, healthcare, and education, those colleges represent three out of four of our workforce shortages in North Carolina. We don't have enough IT professionals. No. We don't have enough teachers. And we don't have enough nurses. So,
and that actually makes sense. Like if I'm out there wanting my child or wanting to hire from somewhere, if you're that aware as a university of what the platforms need to be for a community in North Carolina, I mean, that you're right. That is just like everything that we're looking for, and we're having to import and look for talent on all of those curriculum. The concern though is it's like we don't have, it's not that we don't have enough people coming out of schools necessarily, because we have how many colleges and universities in North Carolina. It's that when they come out and they are highly skilled, that they are able to perform, that they're able to have that life experience and those kind of things, they perform better. We don't have enough of those types of students coming out. Because I know when I interview for entry-level positions for different clients and things, I don't know how many accounting students have come out, don't know anything really about debits and credits. We're going to have that, you know, they're not good on spreadsheets. They're not good on the basic skills that I need them to be good at immediately in their job.
Yeah.
And so we're turning out the wrong skill sets, where it sounds like WGUNC is giving focusing on the life skills and the life application of it, not just the educational aspect.
We are actually just finishing a process right now with an analytics firm where we are literally mapping skills to all of our degree programs, which is absolutely amazing and something that no one else is doing.
So give an example of what you mean by mapping the skills to the program.
So one thing that I hear a lot from employers is that, you know, very similar to what you just said, I'm not getting employees who have the skill sets that I need and want. So what we've done is we've worked with a company that has an open skills library that has been taken from hundreds of thousands of job descriptions and resumes and competencies from industry councils.
So it's the job skills that employers need to be there when they hire Correct. You out of college.
Correct. Okay. And those have been mapped back to our
content.
To our content and our degrees to make sure that we truly are. I mean, our competencies that make up a course all come from industry experts and councils. So we work with the industry to make sure that our content is relevant to them.
So it's not static. So it's not the same.
Correct.
So it's not the same biology class that I took.
No.
Too many decades ago.
We are regularly updating our course offerings and while still maintaining our compliance. Yes.
So we're talking about this, and it's like, so we're saying 49% of the population have a post-secondary degree.
Mm-hmm.
But those may not be what I'm going to call functional degrees because they're not aligning with the skill sets that the employers are looking
mm-hmm.
for. We know that the higher your degree, your education, the more money you make in each position.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a difference. We know that kids aren't being equipped in our public school systems to be successful in post-secondary.
Not all kids,
yeah,
right.
Right. So it's a smaller number than
yep.
than
what
than
we
would
need.
Like.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going to go into college
mm-hmm.
without the basic skill set. They're going to go into debt
mm-hmm.
to either not complete their degree
mm-hmm.
or not be equipped with a functioning degree that when they get recruited out that they're ready to hit the ground running for
mm-hmm.
promotions, learning more,
mm-hmm.
all that kind of stuff. And so how do we change that as a community,
and, so
you know,
yeah.
through the government, through all the part public, private, the employers, all
right.
of that. How do we make changes?
Right. I think that one of the things that I would like to see happen in North Carolina is that we look at our governance structure across K-12, community college, and higher ed. We're not talking to one another, and I think that, and it's, I'm sure this is not just true in North Carolina. But when I say not talking to each other, what I mean is that we're not coordinating.
Right.
We're not even talking the same language half the time. And I think that the language that we should be talking is skills.
Right.
So that's one thing that's kind of a paradigm shift that needs to occur. I think that it's interesting how we have this leaky education pipeline where only 22% of kids in North Carolina graduate from high school every year and complete a four-year degree by the time they're 24.
So less than one in four.
Yes. So actually, it's only 15% with the UNC system. When you factor in kids who go out of state and kids who go to private schools, it jumps up to 22%.
So we have 100 kids in our school.
Yep.
22 of them will go to college, but only 15 of them will stay in North Carolina.
No. So we have 100 kids, and 84% of them are going to graduate from high school.
Okay.
78% will say, yeah, I have post-secondary intentions. I want to do something.
Okay.
I'm not just going to go to work.
So 78% of the 82.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, out of the 100.
Out of the 100.
Okay. Out of the 100. And then about 38% of those will go to community college.
Okay.
And then I think it's like 32% will, so 32 out of the 100 will go to a go away, you know, to a 4-year college. Okay. And out of that, in the only when what we're left with is 15 out of that 100 completing a 4-year degree at a UNC system school by the time they're 24.
So we think of it. So we had 82 go to graduate, and then we start getting down. So the only 15 actually complete the entire educational coursework to come out and say,
by the time
I have a bachelor's degree by the time
they're 24. Yeah. So that, so we, North Carolina has always been able to meet our workforce demand because we are a net importer of talent.
Right.
People come here from other states and they stay. Right now, job growth in North Carolina is on pace by 2024 to outpace population growth.
Oh, wow.
And so we really don't enough
people.
We're going
to have unemployment. But it's going to be because there's no job match to the skills to the jobs
that
are available.
Yeah. So if you think about Europe, they've got a lot of highly qualified people with no jobs.
Right.
Right. They have such high unemployment rates. In the United States, not just in North Carolina, but in the U.S., we have a lot. We have jobs without people because we don't have enough highly skilled people to take the jobs that we need to have.
So it's going to end up the biggest export from Europe is going to be their people and their talent, and our biggest import is ultimately going to be people and talent.
Right.
Because we're not we don't have it.
Right. And what I as a parent, you know, you've probably heard the stat that India and China have more academically gifted kids than we have kids. So more kids in honors classes, et cetera, than we even have kids in the United States. Our children are truly going to be competing in a global economy. And so my kids are not just going to compete against kids from North Carolina. They're not just going to compete against kids from the U.S. They're going to be competing against kids from all over the world.
Well, and if we think, okay, with the coronavirus now sort of is signaling and flagging a lot of things. Because it's like a lot of the live events are now going online. How many events will ultimately still stay online rather than having in-person events and all the expense when they look and say, it's like, hey, we only expected 1,000 people at this live event because we went online, 10,000 people attended, right? I think we're going to have that shift to more people becoming more aware that their business models still work and maybe even work better and are less expensive the more virtual we are, the more connected we are through internet and those kind of things. So I think we're going to see something that businesses have been lagging on and everything is letting people telecommute. I mean, there for a while it was a big push, and then they wanted everybody because it was a command and control thing, honestly.
Yeah.
And so they want to see their people working, not just measure the work product, right? And so when we're thinking about those shifts, it is a global economy.
Yes.
It's that business that's in China, that business that's in India. They don't even have to immigrate here if everything starts truly being
correct.
Globally, virtually sourced, delivered, and those kind of things. And so it's when we think about that, and I don't think we're going to say, I'm going to change the term from academically gifted to academically equipped.
Because
I think we have an entire generation of incredibly gifted kids that are getting lost because they're not getting it taught to them in the manner in which they can absorb it. Mm-hmm. Or they're bored because by the time the teacher deals with 47 different languages in her class, there's no time to teach.
Yeah.
All of those kind of things.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest complaints that I hear from teachers is that they don't have time to teach. And it's because, this is particular to low-income counties where they have larger numbers of English language learners, larger numbers of kids who live in poverty and have food insecurity. This, when teachers are serving as social workers and nurses, they've got less time to teach.
And trauma specialists.
And trauma specialists, that's right. And that's one of the things that I do think money can help with, because we're not funding those positions in our low-income counties at the ratio that we need to.
Well, and so when we look at this, because we see a growing student debt problem,
mm-hmm.
and so they're spending all of this money And I've talked to several people that went for online degrees. They didn't finish it. It was, you know, it was a lot of things that came into play is why they didn't finish it. But yet, so, you know, when they said, well, I'm $50,000 in debt in student loans, I'm like, no, I'm going to argue with you that, yes, you may have taken them as student loans, but your tuition and your books and your expenses for that were not $50,000.
That's right.
You borrowed the max because they would let you do that.
That's right.
You bought a car, you bought furniture, you took a vacation. It wasn't used for your education. So let's differentiate that and only start talking about how much money do I need to borrow to do my education, work full time, do the things to fund that, and not muddy the waters that, yes, you're $50,000 in debt, but it did not go for $50,000 in tuition. It yeah. didn't go for you to end up with a PhD.
That's right. And so we have to change the model of federal financial aid, because that's just free money. And in any other, it's money that doesn't, they cannot, if you default on that loan, they can't call that. Exactly. So to your point, I have a friend whose daughter started at ECU this year. And he told me that last year when they were going through the federal financial aid process, it to go to ECU and live on campus all in would be $20,000 a year. She was offered $28,000 a year
right.
by the federal. So that's an additional $32,000 that she didn't need to take out. Now, the same thing, we noticed at WGU that the same thing was happening. So in 2013, we started something that we call the Responsible Borrowing Initiative. And what that means is that we have trained our enrollment counselors, who I mentioned before,
right.
spend a lot of one-on-one time with potential students. We have trained them to help students figure out what they need to take out in student loan if they are going to take out a loan from the federal government. And as a result, we have, since 2013, have reduced our students' debt by over $400 million.
And that is life enabling. Then whenever you go out into the career, you get more options when you're not in debt.
Right. Exactly.
You don't have, I mean.
That's exactly
you
right.
You get the freedom to say, okay, this job isn't working.
Yep.
I can change because, and I can take something that fits me more personality wise, but may pay less because I don't have $100,000 in student loan debt.
Yeah.
And so I made it through undergrad. I worked full time most of the time as an undergrad, went to school full time. My mom went back to work. So we came through on scholarships and just sweat
right.
equity, right?
Right.
Debt free.
Right.
To a private school. I worked 3 years. I saved half of every paycheck. And so when I went for my master's degree, I didn't have to take out loans. Could I have gone to London School of Economics? Yes, I got in. But I looked and said, no, that's not where I want to.
Well, and yeah, that's why people are so up in arms when we talk about wiping away all of the student debt, because people like you made a choice to be responsible
right.
and not go to the fancy school that would create more debt.
State. It wasn't a bad school. I mean, it's a
right.
top and but I could afford it.
Right.
I had in-state tuition. I had lived in the state. And so yeah. you look at it in mathematics and say, if I wanted to go to Harvard, I could go to Harvard.
Right.
But what was the degree or the career path that I wanted to, and did I have to go to Harvard
right.
for that career path? I see kids that are going for teaching degrees, and one of my friend's daughters was doing this. She was getting C grades at a very expensive school, going into debt, borrowing $50,000 a year. So she's coming out to go to what education. So she wasn't performing well. Mm-hmm. She didn't fit, all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to come out and get, what, a $35,000, $45,000 starting
mm-hmm.
salary that she's going to have to pay taxes out of and all of these other things.
Right.
And she has a student loan debt that
yep.
is five times her beginning salary.
Right. And this is why the idea of free college doesn't work. We can't talk about free college until we talk about changing the way that federal financial aid works. So it's just throwing good money after bad.
You value free.
Well, that's
right?
true as well. Yeah.
So I knew that when I had a limited amount of time, I carried 18 hours some semesters, I carried 21 hours some semesters. When I was in the quarter system, you know, we were supposed to take, I think it was 14 hours, and I had 20 hours some quarters. And they're like, you can't do that. I said, as long as my grades are there and the computer lets me and I can pay for it, then I can do that because that's my choice. So, yes, I can work 3 or 4 part-time jobs. I can do whatever it takes. And every minute is towards what is this goal I have.
Yeah.
And I valued that. Every minute had to count, every dollar I earned. And I'm still that way. I can afford to pay for things, but I am going to, if I can find a coupon, if I can get reward points, I am not wasting that. And so everything is a decision. And, you know, I try to tell everybody, it's like, what's that outcome? You know, $200,000 in debt and a C grade level at a tier one school. Okay, yeah, you got that degree from a tier one school, but you're going for a teaching degree.
Right.
And reality is, if you were a nuclear physicist with a tier one degree, or you're a political scientist coming out of Harvard or Yale or one of those schools, it's a different impact on versus being a teacher coming out of a Harvard education.
Well, I think one of the things that I've talked to people a lot while I was on the campaign trail about is the idea that not all kids need to go to a four-year university. When I worked for President Spellings, she used to talk a lot about the on-ramps and off-ramps in education. And that is what we need. We need, you know, just because you're not going to go to college now doesn't mean that you're not going to go someday.
Right.
But there's nothing that says that you have to have this rite of passage.
Four years of partying because you don't know what you want to do.
And even, you know, living on campus even. I mean, if you think about living on campus is half the cost. So I think that we're going to see some significant changes with the number of kids who go and live away at college. I think that in the next 10 years, we're going to see fewer and fewer kids actually going away.
I mean, I went to a private school and it was non-traditional. I had a lot of things happen. I had several family relatives close to me die right before I was supposed to start college. I just went to the local private school. I had worked hard in high school and stuff. I had all the grades and stuff. And I walked in and said, I want to come here. And they're like, great, here's the application process. I said, well, I want to start this semester. And they said, well, the door is closed. And I said, okay, but here's my, you know, straight A's and here's this and here's the community services. They're like, oh, yeah. And I said, oh, and I need a scholarship. And it's like, but I had laid all that groundwork so that any school was going to take me. Did I go to the best high school? Did I always have the best teachers? No. Did I run through the gifted program and get some things out of that? Yes. But when I worked, or if I needed help, someone in my family, like my grandfather taught me long division. I don't know if you guys are younger than me, but how they started teaching long division did not make sense to me. And I can remember being in third grade in tears. And he goes, what is wrong? And I said, this doesn't make sense. He goes, okay, here's what you do. This is how it works. I was like, okay, that makes sense. He goes, now just make it look like you did it the way they wanted to do it, right? And I was like, okay, that makes sense.
That sounds a lot like parents today with Common Core math standards.
Well, and it was just like, and you looked at it, and I was like, I don't understand. And it was that frustration because it's like, that's not how my brain works. And I had that problem in calculus because I could look down and do the problem, especially if he'd already done it once in class, right? And it was just stuck in my head. And you got to show your work. I said, but I know the answer. And he's like, but you got to show your work. And I'm like, okay, I would have to work down and then I have to. And he's like, if you know the answer, how can you not show the work? I said, because my brain did the work.
Exactly.
Right? And it doesn't work to that. As long as I got the answer. I mean, send me in a room by myself and let me do the test if that's what you're concerned about. But it's that adaption and that, you know, what is the motivation? What is your support system? Who at home, if my grandfather hadn't helped me with long division, I don't know what the next step would have been, right?
Right.
Where like my brother had problems with math. He didn't get fractions. He didn't get percentages. He literally didn't get taught them in the same schools I did. But my approach was different than his. And my parents learned something based on his experience 3 years ahead of me to know, okay, this is going to be a problem. We need to address it here. And he was brilliant at science. He could do math. He just was never taught all the different elements of it. And I could do math, no problem. I hated geometry. I still hate it. I still remember side, angle, side, and all that kind of stuff. But it's when we don't take into consideration those learning styles or what did somebody miss? Where's that remedial step? If eighth graders can't read and do math and we know it, then it stops now.
Right.
There has to be some intervention process. It's like, okay, wait a minute. We're not going to teach anything else until they have those two skills. If that's 8 hours a day for an entire semester, only doing reading and math, then let's do it that way.
Yeah.
Because we've lost them. And if they're frustrated, if they think they're stupid, and I hear that from kids all the time.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
It's like, I'm too stupid. I'm just like, you're not stupid. No one's giving you the right methods.
Yeah.
I was talking to my 10-year-old stepson. He has to touch everything, and the teacher hates he has to touch everything. I said, that means he's a kinesthetic learner. And they're like, what are you talking about? They're trying to do computers. He has to touch every component. Mm-hmm. He won't read the directions. I said, he's not visual. Let the kid do it the way he builds it correctly every time, but he's mm-hmm. not following the steps.
Right.
And they're frustrated, and they're trying to control. And I said, you can't control how God wired him to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Give him what he needs to learn that way. And he is phenomenal putting computers together, computers, robots, anything robotic, anything mechanical. But they said, but he won't look at the directions, and it frustrates everybody. I said, then put him off by himself or with other people that learn that way, and let them tear it up
mm-hmm.
and be excited about the project instead of he just stands there. He's not going to engage. He's just completely withdrawn from everything.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't fit. He's wrong. He's stupid. He, mm-hmm. you know. And I can understand the teacher's frustrations, and I can understand the parents' frustrations. But we're losing this 10-year-old child that could probably be brilliant engineer, innovating technology, building things. And how many of them are we losing? How many Albert Einsteins are we losing?
Yeah.
How many Marie Curies are we losing? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all of these different boys and girls that are being reinforced that because they don't do it the way the system prescribes, or they need a little bit more time,
mm-hmm.
or they have a dyslexia, or they have something in there that's not diagnosed. And it's like, we can't afford to lose these valuable resources. We're not right. going to have enough of them. And to say, we just keep doing the same thing over, that is insanity.
Right.
And if we can do it at the college level, why can't we do it in pre-K yeah. and K?
I mean,
if you're students in those grades.
If you think about it, our K-12 system of education looks exactly the same as it did 120 years ago. Age grading is an appropriate
right.
thing anymore when you're not just preparing kids to be farmers or factory workers.
Well, and a 3-year-old with an iPad or a smartphone or a computer at home is different from the economic disadvantaged child coming in. And so that disparity is only going to magnify the longer we have them in the same
right.
class.
That's why competency-based learning, I believe, is the future of K-12 education.
How do we get there?
Well, we actually have schools across the country who are doing this and doing it well. And
private schools?
Nope, they're public schools.
Oh,
and
wow.
one of them is in North Carolina, Carroll Middle School
okay.
in Raleigh. And I have been to visit there. But it is, if you think about the idea that you can't move on until you have mastered a concept at, if you have to think about it as a grade, at a B or better.
Right.
Why should someone move on in math if they haven't mastered it? Competency-based education takes away any sort of inherent teacher bias.
Right.
Or issues with
it's binary. You have the skill or you don't have
the
skill.
That's exactly right. You can do this or you can't. And if you can do it, here are some other ways that you can go even further.
Right.
Before we move on to the next thing. And it's really when you know, equity is going to be a huge part of this upcoming election, in North Carolina for the role that I'm running for. Of state superintendent, because we have a mandate from the court that says we have to start providing equity in our public schools. And that means different things to different people. And so we're going to have some tough conversations about what that means. But for me, one piece of that is all kids need to be given the chance to learn as much as they can in a way that is right for them.
That pursuit of happiness, it starts with an education.
For sure.
Well, I can't believe it, but the hour's up.
Wow.
You'll have to come back because this conversation is so not over.
Oh,
because
great.
It impacts every student. It impacts every household, whether you have kids or not. And so I want to thank Catherine Truitt of WGUNC for being here. She is the candidate for superintendent of public education here in North Carolina. So check out her website. We're going to have the podcast available on focusonbusinessradio.com, and I'll put some links to WGUNC and to Catherine's information. And I want to thank her for being here live in the studio, and I want to thank everyone for tuning in to the show today. And until next time, everyone, stay focused on the important things.